tonight on Arena. The Fall Guide, The Idea of You and Love Lies Bleeding are the movies up for review. And Elaine Feeney on her new poetry collection, All the Good Things You Deserve. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can catch the live stream on rte.ie/arena. We start with film reviews tonight. The Fall Guy is an action-packed comedy starring former Barbie versus Oppenheimer rivals Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt. It's directed by David Leitch, a man who himself is a former stuntman, and it follows a down-and-out stuntman who is working on his ex-girlfriend's directorial debut blockbuster film. Next up, The Idea of You, a romantic comedy directed by Michael Showalter, who also directed the critically acclaimed The Big Sick. This is based on a debut novel from an American author, Robin Lee. The film stars Anne Hathaway as Celine, a 40-year-old single mum who begins an unexpected romance with a 24-year-old boy band star, played by Hayes Campbell. Sorry, Hayes Campbell is the character, played by Nicholas Galitzine. And finally, from director Rose Glass, we have Love Lies Bleeding, romantic thriller starring Kristen Stewart as a gym manager called Lou who falls for a bodybuilder called Jackie, played by Katie O'Brien. So what is going on as she is passing through her town en route to a competition in Las Vegas? Donald Clark and Arlene Hunt have been to the cinema first. They're with me in studio this evening. And let's start with The Fall Guy. Fall Guy is obviously, Arlene, a term for a stuntman, which is what Ryan Gosling is playing here. Does what it says in the tin, I guess.
Very much so. I mean, it's a... I think what they were trying to go for here was kind of a romantic the stone kind of high action, high, slightly camp, high version of everything. And, you know, we would have like an amazing chemistry between the two lead stars and, you know, a story with lots of pop and fizzle and obviously a lot of stunts.
Yeah.
You know, because it's based on the character from the 80s, the Lee Major character from the 80s. You know, the TV show that used to be on every Saturday morning.
Yeah, but when I heard Lee Majors, I thought, surely... The
$6 million man. What are they thinking?
Whose music is in the midst of our theme tune somewhere, and I always love doing the slow motion running.
Well, there is actually there's a 10-second audio reference to that in the film.
Yeah.
In the middle of one complex fight, it goes, you get that noise that you got whenever he
jumped,
did something very, very strong or very fast.
He jumped an open drawbridge. He jumped an open drawbridge.
In this film?
Tarzan from a Vine.
That's right.
And the unknown stuntman.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, we're in a strange situation currently. A sense of desperation is setting in at the top of the cinematic tree, I think. I mean, we already knew that intellectual property rather than movie stars are the selling points. But does IP really matter when it's a bad TV show from the 1980s that I don't think is remembered all that fondly?
Yeah, because the minute Lee Majors was mentioned, I thought, oh, this
$6 million
to
dollar
be,
man.
No, it was called The Fall Guy, wasn't it? The television series, was it?
This was called The Fall Guy, yes. Yeah. But you're right, but The $6 million Man has been in development hell for 30 years.
Oh, right.
I mean, every movie star of any size has been associated with it. And I agree with Arlene. I think there's a sense of what the core of the piece is they're going for a kind of screwball thing. They're going going back through Romancing the Stone, back to His Girl Friday and so forth. And I got a real sense of awful desperation in the performance, as if they're trying really, really hard to get this chemistry going that's not there. The dialogue is overlapping. They're firing it out almost quicker than you can hear, as indeed would Cary Grant have done in His Girl Friday. And there's even a hint of improvisation, though that may be my imagination because the dialogue is so thin. I'm assuming it must be improvised. It couldn't be written down on the page. And none of that really makes that chemistry work. I mean, it's as if they're working with inert material and it just never really fires up.
Well, let's listen to a clip featuring Ryan Gosling as Colt Seavers. Good name, has to be said. Speaking to Jodie Monino, played by Emily Blunt. And she is his ex-girlfriend, as I say. And here she is directing her blockbuster film when who appears on set to be the stuntman but the bowel Ryan.
Why are you here?
I think there's been a misunderstanding.
Clearly.
Because I was under the impression that you did want me here.
That's a delusional thought. We haven't spoken in a year.
I'm happy for you. This whole director thing looks good on you. Even the gardening hat, somehow.
Everyone wears them. It's like a set thing. okay?
Yeah, I see it. It's they're not making it look as good as you are, that's all. And I'm not trying to be flat. I'm just saying the facts. But you look good in everything. You look good in nothing, whatever. No, I don't mean
really?
It like that.
This
you do look good in nothing.
This isn't going to work.
You do, but it's not what I'm...
There you go, Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in a scene from The Fall Guy. I was saying as we were listening to that, Arlene, I saw Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt interviewed on BBC Breakfast.
I saw it too.
And they were working so hard at being best buddies.
It was an awkward interview, I think is probably the fairest way to describe that.
Yeah. So obviously the offstage working hard on the chemistry was exactly what was happening on screen as well.
Yeah, it's difficult. Like, there's some lovely little moments in it. You know, there's one scene where he ties her sun hat when they're out on the beach, and it's just a little gentle movement. And I wish there had been more of that in it. You know, that little kind of affectionate thing. And it's they're only short of punching each other in the shoulder and calling each other bro. You know, it's just not sexy.
And a terrible, embarrassing thing going on throughout this, where they use this kind of supposedly clever postmodern techniques to make excuses for the screenplay. So there's one point at which they say, talking about the film within a film, it's like, well, it has no third act, and never mind, it'll be fine, we'll work it out in post or whatever, or something to that effect.
Yeah.
There's all that kind of self-deprecation running the way through. Which is
the split screen.
Exactly. There's a point at which some point she said, let's do it in split screen, and it becomes split screen. And always kind of self-referential stuff. But that doesn't make up for the fact that at its core, you've got a story that doesn't work, and dialogue that is flat, and a MacGuffin that is hard to even identify as a MacGuffin. I don't know what this film is about. And in the sense of, I can't remember why Aaron Taylor-Johnson, who plays Tom Cruise character, ends up in trouble and who's in trouble with and all that stuff.
I think it wasn't really well written for him, because I don't think whatever happens to him or why he ends up in trouble is even remotely important.
Yeah, so it's not even a MacGuffin.
What is left from the original television series? No. You might say there's nothing worth retaining from original television series, but nonetheless, he was, if I recall correctly, was a stuntman who was also a bounty hunter.
Yeah.
Now, all you've really got left from that is the fact that he was a stuntman. There's nothing else really left from that. So why bother, given that a vanishingly small percentage of the cinema-going population are going to remember that series, and a smaller percentage of that are going to actually have any great affection for it?
Well, Vinny in East Mayo was very swift to point out he never watched The $6 Million Man, but he loved The Fall Guy.
We know they were two
totally separate. This is a different texture yet. We do know that they were two entirely separate TV series, yes. But when I heard the name Lee Majors, I automatically thought of The $6 Million Man. What about the action sequences in the film then? Just to be clear, we're talking about the film, The Fall Guy.
Some good ones, some not so good. There's a lot of green screen, I think, in this, which is disappointing because I'm not giving anything away here. There's outtakes in this which are made with real stuntmen, and they look amazing. Mm. So... it's baffling.
Why are they outtakes?
It's bad, but it's baffling to me why, if you're going to base a film on a real stuntman, that you wouldn't really lean into having actual stunts and, you know, real setups and real stunt setups.
Yeah, I mean, I assumed that I would learn something about the techniques of stunt work. And you don't, because
apart from the opening one where he falls, which is the very opening scene where it's the start of the plot, you know, where he gets injured and he falls backward. That's quite an interesting scene because you see the setup and you think, oh, that's how they do that. And if there was more of that in it, you know, it would be much more interesting.
Okay, so a little bit more humanity in the story was what you were looking for. Stars from you, Arlene?
I gave it 3 out of 5 because, as dodgy as the plot was, at least it entertained me to the end.
And they can be quite charming, the two of them.
Separately, they're fine.
Emily Blunt.
I think everyone likes these two actors. Yeah. I mean, no one's got a beef with Ryan Gosling or Emily Blunt.
Baby Goose, how would you have a beef with Baby Goose? Everyone loves him.
Yeah, but not in this, no. Okay. Well, I mean, we should say I'm going no higher than 2, Sean. I thought it was rubbish. But it has got tremendously good reviews coming out of South by Southwest and Austin. So do take our word for it. We're brilliant. But if you think we're wrong, don't blame us. We welcome all opinions.
Critics differ, and sometimes films survive anyway. It has to be said. Let's move on to The Idea of You, A Mate to September. I'm saying rom-com starring Anne Hathaway as a 40-year-old single mother who falls in love for a 24-year-old boy band superstar played by Nicholas Galitzine. not actually opening in Irish cinemas, but will instead stream on Prime. You are so happy to hear that it's going to Prime, I believe, Donald. Like, this is another example. This is another example of what's wrong with cinema. Why doesn't it even go to the cinema for a couple of weeks?
This is the second potentially big film in the last month or two. The other one being Roadhouse. I didn't much care for Roadhouse, but that's not really the point. The point is you're surely leaving money on the table in this case. People would have gone to see Roadhouse. They'd have gone to see Conor McGregor, nothing else.
Yeah.
And in this case, the cinema has been deprived of, romantic, we'll call it a romantic comedy for the sake of argument. It's actually a romantic comedy for the first half, and then it becomes more of a romantic drama, but let's not get too tied up in that definition. Romantic comedies, they don't put them in cinemas any longer. I mean, it was that film that was Sydney Sweeney at the end of last year, which was a hit, and that showed people that you can do this, and yet here is Prime putting it again straight to streaming. For me, I thought this was great. I thought this was the best mainstream rom-com, stick with that, that is produced in quite some time. It's got a nice premise. It basically works to the Notting Hill template, I would say, in that you have somebody who's not really that familiar with a superstar who becomes involved with that superstar.
Except it's the other way around this time. Yes. It's the young fella who's the superstar.
In this case, Anne Hathaway.
Selena, the Anne Hathaway, who's the ordinary person.
Really nicely staged. I like how they've handled the music in this. A bit too much of it, but the music was believable for me. And I thought it was terrific, and I'm disappointed that people can't go with their special other and go and see it in the cinema.
All right. Arlene, I don't know if those watching on the live stream saw the slight tensing of your face as Donald was speaking there. I think you were at a different film.
Well, now, see, I found the premise ludicrous from the outset.
What's ludicrous about... what part of that premise is ludicrous?
Well, first of all, the whole setup for me was daft. Like, she goes to Coachella with her 17-year-old daughter because her tadpole of a husband bailed at the last moment. So she brings her friends, even though she has plans of her own. And this is a 40-year-old businesswoman. And so she brings her daughter along to Coachella, and then the kids immediately ditch her there because they're too cool for school and they've outgrown this boy band, which made sense to me because they're a boy band.
Yeah.
And then she wanders along looking for a bathroom, and there's no security, so she ends up going into his trailer where she meets him, and they instantly make googly eyes at each other. He's like a basset hound that discovered a block of cheese. That's the only way I can describe the way he looks at her.
A basset hound that has discovered
cheese. That's the way he looks at her. And this, the whole thing is like, you know, there's nothing sexy about it. That's what annoyed me about it most.
All right,
there's nothing sexy about it.
Let's listen to a scene between the two of them. And this is where Hayes Campbell, the character played by Nellix Galitzine, comes into Selena. Is it Selene? There's the little accent on the E now. It's explained to me. She has an art shop. Is he going to buy anything?
She has an art gallery.
An art gallery. I beg your pardon. Is he going to buy anything? Let's have a listen.
These pieces are by a local artist, Amanda Friedman. She lives in Eagle Rock. She chose to feature a strong light source, as if aliens had just landed. Mm. These are shot on a medium and large format camera, on film, no digital manipulation.
So cool. I'll take them all.
What?
If you could bubble wrap them or whatever, and then I'll send someone over later just to pick them up. These bowls, by the way, these are lovely.
Thank you.
And the spaghetti tiles, I mean, the detail is beautiful. And whatever this is, I want it in my home. Honestly, I think I'll take all of it.
This is real art. These are real artists. They take their work very seriously, as do I. They made it with a great deal of care. And you're coming in here like, I don't know, like you're buying apples or something.
Honestly, I've been looking for work like this for so long, and I genuinely connect with it, and so I would really like to buy it if it's okay with you.
Okay. Okay.
And for the record, you have never seen me buy apples before.
This businesswoman is now giving out to this guy because he wants to buy all of the stock in her store, all of her art gear.
But I found that kind of, there's something charming in that.
Well, she lets him buy it in the end, doesn't she?
She lets him, yes. She lets him buy it.
I mean, it's not as if she actually resists him buying everything in the shop.
No, she just scolds him first.
I mean, I think I like the relationship between the two of them. I would say that that Hayes Campbell, the pop star, is maybe just too nice. There are nice pop stars, of course there are, but I'm not sure many have remained quite so sweet having gone through this sort of trauma.
Hang on a second. He even says it in the film. He got signed at 14, so he's 10 years in the business. This is no sort of ingenue, young puppet, like basset hound who's popped into the scene.
But I do think, I mean, I think as often in this genre of film, the female character is better developed. And I think she is kind of, does to me live on the screen. There's a lovely tense moment, I think, after when they first kiss and she says, I'm too old for you. And you really feel that she doesn't really believe that.
She should have said that before she kissed him, really.
Well, but I think the point is that she doesn't clearly doesn't believe that. Right? I mean, the thing is, she's saying that to convince herself, or actually not even to convince herself, she's saying it because she feels that she should say that, even though she doesn't really think that there's any real reason why they shouldn't be together. I thought that was quite touching and actually gets at the tension that's working there. I mean, and also, I think just in terms of where this film lands in the culture, I mean, it's an interesting comparison with Notting Hill in that at that stage, obviously part of the thing was that Hugh Grant's life changed and it became difficult. But it's so much worse now, particularly when dealing with a pop star. We know that if something had happened, I mean, was reminded a little bit of the speculation that gathered around Olivia Wilde and Harry Styles about a year and a half ago, the time of Don't Worry, Darling. Don't Worry, Darling? Don't Worry.
Yep.
And just people go absolutely bananas. And that actually becomes the tension in the relationship. Right. That, I mean, they get over the fact.
I just want to point out that these people, she goes on a European tour. I don't care if people read, loads of people have read the book. They go on a tour together. And then they're canoodling in a packed cafe and are shocked that someone has taken their photograph.
I think in this genre, that's okay. I don't think you're looking for like Mike Leigh or Ken Loach in this situation. I think there are certain conventions you can get. There are certain, you can let them away with certain illogicalities in these sorts of pictures. I think that's perfectly fine. As you would if it was like an absurd, if it was a Fall Guy. But no, but I think that doesn't, what Hitchcock used to call the possible, doesn't worry
both
me
of you
that
on
much.
The great screwball comedy patter that you both have given me in that argument.
Serious chemistry. That's what was missing from the Fall Guy. See how easy it is?
Yeah, that's real chemistry. But again, the looks on your face, Arlene, I'll give you a final word on it.
Well, you know, it just wasn't for me. And I'm not sure this kind of attempt at a rom-com is for me. I mean, I asked a friend of mine who'd read the original book, and the book is very, just so people know if they want to see this because they've based it on the book is very different, and she's a very different character in the book than she is portrayed upon in this movie. And that should be something to take in mind if you love the book, and a lot of people do.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to say on it. Just that's
all
I'm going
to
say.
Book to film is always a really hairy area. Let's not start another screwball comedy
on
that.
I accept that, okay. But just be aware of that. She's a different character. I'm giving it 2 out of 5 because it ended.
and now, Donald, I'm wondering, was it your inner boy band star that was tickled here, or was it the buying up all that art in the art gallery?
What was tickled? Rom-coms. I mean, I've got no, I've absolutely no hesitation in admitting to that, if admitting is the word. No, I gave it a 4. I thought it was just terrific. I have rarely had on few occasions have I had a better time in the cinema this year.
There we go.
I know. Actually, I wasn't in the cinema, but you know, I was watching it at home, but that's what we discussed. But you know,
okay,
I mean,
yeah, all right. 2 and 4, and a wonderful difference of opinion both there. Finally, then, Love Lies Bleeding. I'm calling it a romantic thriller. Unfortunately, Donald, you'll be arguing with yourself on this one because you have seen this. Gym manager Lou, played by Kristen Stewart, who falls for a bodybuilder called Jackie, played by Katie O'Brien. We're in 1989. Is that important? Do we see... Is the period important in terms of the story that's been told?
I'll tell you why I think it is important. This is from Rose Glass, who made a great horror film called St. Maud, which I think was sort of a kind of pandemic hit. I remember it was one of those films a lot of people watched in the pandemic and really warmed to. So this was about 4 years ago. That was a great critical hit, made her name. And there's a lot of European film directors who, when that's happened, they need to go and exercise their inner Americana. All those years back, John Borman going to make Point Blank in the United States, or Wim Wenders making Paris, Texas. You know, films that are very much about America and about Americana. Now, I think something has changed the last 20 or 30 years, and I don't think America is as foreign or as exciting or as romantic as it was to that generation of Wenders and Borman. And so I think that's partly the reason why Rose Glass had to move it back to 1989, to an era when it was still seemed more foreign than America seems now. And set in an area, part of the country, Portland, New Mexico, where you could really still feel you're on a whole different planet to the rest of the world. It's a noir is a much overused word, but I think it'll work here in the style of Jim Thompson, the kind of rough, grubby noir. Kristen Stewart is working, when we first meet her, she's working in a gym. it starts as it means to go on. We first meet her unclogging a lavatory that is very graphically full of what goes down lavatories. And then, as always happens with this kind of noir, this kind of pseudo-Western, a stranger wanders into town. The stranger in this case is Katie O'Brien, right, who's a bodybuilder who starts off being quite volatile and then gets a lot more volatile when Kirsten Stewart's character introduces her to steroids.
We've been talking a lot about chemistry this evening, and we don't need to go to the steroids one side of the chemistry here, but the chemistry between the two characters here, Kirsten Stewart and Katie O'Brien, the two actors rather, does that play into the relationship?
Oh, yeah.
Is it strong?
They're terrific. I mean, I'm a great fan of Kirsten Stewart. I think everyone is. And and I think she has this thing again. One of the things that she does is that she kind of hides sensitivity and passion behind a collection of very millennial shrugs, if you know what I mean. That's kind of her thing. But you're always aware, because she's a very gifted actress, that something really furious is
happening
going on
underneath
all that. Whereas Katie O'Brien is the unleashed id. All her emotions are out there in front, and often in front violently. But all the characters are great. Ed Harris is in there as Kirsten Stewart's father and the local kingpin, almost being outacted by his hair. His hair is spectacular. It's like, you know, it's like full heavy metal hair from 1984 on a man of a certain age, and he's terrific in this. Towards the end, it kind of leans a bit into a kind of magic realist thing, which I was okay with. Some people have felt that it's incongruous, but I think it's clearly not supposed to be actually happening. That is supposed to be
stars on it, Donald.
Oh, Comfortable Four. I thought it was great.
So you had two good times at the movie.
I did.
You certainly did. So the final one that we were speaking about there, Love Lies Bleeding, will be in cinemas nationwide from Friday.
Very violent, I would say, just to be cautious. It is very violent if you're uneasy about those things.
Okay. The Idea of You, which, according to one texter, so it was a Mars and Venus vote on the rom-com, is the comment from our texter this evening.
But not the way you'd expect.
Exactly, the other way around. It was a kind of, I don't know how you say that. Prime Video, it's streaming from today. And the first film that we spoke about, The Fall Guy, is in cinemas on general release from today. And continuing the $6 Million Man theme, David Donegal is keen that we know that the $6 Million Man can be seen nightly on Legend Channel, which I'm enjoying. I hope it's on after 8 o'clock, Dave. Surely enjoy calls. All right, thank you to Donald Clark and Arlene Hunt. The International Dublin Gay Theatre Festival begins next Monday and runs for 2 weeks. One of the shows is a production of Alexi K. Campbell's prize-winning 2008 play The Pride, and it's been produced by Unsha Anish Theatre. The Pride is set in the United Kingdom across two time frames, in the 1950s and in the present. It explores the struggles and seismic changes in attitudes to sexuality that have taken place over 50 years through two different versions of three characters, Philip, Oliver and Sylvia. With me in studio this evening, the director of this production, Emma Dargan-Reed, and by the actor playing the part of Oliver in 1958 and 2008, Benedict Lansbert-Noon. This play, first of all, Emma, you were telling me just as we were coming to her, you're pretty certain this is the first time it's been produced in Ireland, but it has been a very successful play internationally.
Incredibly successful, yes. It's been performed in Japan, New Zealand, Australia, which just shows like how relatable it is to many different kinds of audiences. So we're very privileged to be able to have it put on an island for the first time.
And how do you describe these two time frames and what the relationship between the characters we meet in 1958 and the characters we meet in 2008, isn't it? 2008 is the
2008.
Exactly 50 years between the two sets of, and they kind of intercut. We get one from 1958, another scene from 2008, and they overlap like that.
Yeah, absolutely. There are definitely similar echoes that happen between the two timelines and these characters. Themes of betrayal and loneliness and what it means to be human and the privilege of having a voice and being heard. the things that these two or these characters all face in these two timelines.
And we have these three characters essentially. There are other characters who appear, but for the most part, we're concentrating on Oliver, who in 1958 is a children's book writer of children's books.
Correct.
Philip, who is married to Sylvia, and Sylvia is an illustrator of children's books. So that's the dynamic in 1958. I come to you on this one, Benedict.
Yeah.
That character in 1958, is he a totally different person in your mind from the same name, Oliver, who we meet in 2008, who isn't 50 years older and who hasn't been a children's author? He's now a journalist.
Yes.
So the characters shift in terms of who they are and what they do. How are they related to each other?
So this is a really interesting question. So I think for me, it kind of pulls back into what the play is about as a whole, honestly, where I think so much of the play is exploring how much of a person's fundamental being can change depending on what society they're brought up in and where they live. So in my mind, Oliver is the exact same person, but is shaped by the society he's in and what he's allowed to be doing at the time.
Right. So the Oliver, if Oliver is born in whatever, he's probably born in 1940
somewhere.
This is what would happen to him in 1958. If he had been born in the 1990s, this is where he would be in 2008.
Exactly.
So tell us about the Oliver from 1958.
Absolutely. So Oliver in 1958 is a children's book writer. He's a novelist. He's a young man in his sort of mid to late 20s. He's a gay man in 1958, which I think you kind of see through the play. He kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? He crystallizes ideas around his identity and his sexuality during the play. Because during the time in 1958, it's a really tricky time to be a gay man. It was literally illegal at the time. There was a recent report that had come out saying that being gay shouldn't be a crime, but it still was until 1968, I believe. And it was an offence that you could be arrested for and prosecuted for. So I think to have a character who is so dead set and understands himself so clearly in that time where it was so taboo to be who he was, it's really something special.
One of the interesting aspects then of the scenes that we get in those 1958 sections of the play then, Emma, is the fact that they both Oliver and Philip, who were trying to work out what exactly his sexuality is in this section of the play, it's what's not said that is the most important here.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's all of that. It's this idea of them not being able to live truly as themselves. And, like, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of, like, undertones of, like, will they, won't they? But that's what's so brilliant. And we're very lucky to have the actors that we have because it's communicated so clearly just without the language in a play that has so much focus on the language itself.
Yeah, because one of the strongest scenes for me in the play is, forgiving your presence here, Benedict, is a scene between Philip and Sylvia in 1958 where she's kind of giving him every chance to tell her that he may or may not be a gay man, and he just can't get himself to that place.
No, not at all. And it's very heartbreaking to see. And just this idea that there is this complete wall up. And like, he's an example of a lot of men at that time who felt a deep shame and isolation and a guilt for having these thoughts and for behaving that way. And even more heartbreaking that you see him actually find a love and a real happiness for a moment. But his ideals and his beliefs and who he thinks these people are completely override any sort of happiness that he might gain.
Yeah, and he is, isn't it in that time period too where he is potentially putting himself through a terrible type of aversion therapy where he looks at gay pornography and it then has to throw up immediately and has to keep the photography around himself. Did that therapy exist?
Yeah, well, you did a lot of research around that at the time, and there were a few different methods, but this was one that was very much happening in the 1950s, where you would be injected with, I believe it's called apomorphine.
Yeah.
And it would do exactly as you said. They would do it two or three times through the night, and you'd sit there looking at these images of gay pornography and just be throwing up. And I think it's even in the play it says they would tend to not give you a bucket, so you'd be throwing up on the floor, on the desk, all over, and you had to sit in that for hours and hours to try and convince you or create a disgust around these things.
Yeah.
Then we come to these other sections in 2008. What struck you about the changed society and this new Oliver, who, has many of the old characteristics, but he's now a journalist and he's been taken in to write essentially a magazine article about the nature of gay sex?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think Oliver in 2008 is a really interesting one where I think he's almost a victim of his freedom in a funny way, where you see Oliver in 1958 and he has this clarity of who he is by the end of the play. And I think Oliver in 2008 is going on a very similar journey in the sense that there's a certain image of what a gay man is in the mid to late 2000s. And I think Oliver feels that quite heavily and isn't quite sure of who he really truly is. And I think by the end of the play, he starts to realize, right, well, maybe the ideas and images I've been fed of what a gay man should be aren't actually right for me either. And the kind of identity around that. But yeah, he's a journalist in 2008 and actually quits that by the end of the play and becomes a novelist.
Yeah, which is interesting given that he was a novelist in the 1958 version
100%.
Of the character himself. It is striking from what Benedict's saying there, Emma, that the presumption would be, oh, in 2008, everything's fine. These men wouldn't have to hide their homosexuality. They could have an open relationship. Society would accept it. Maybe 2008 wasn't quite fully there, certainly in terms of the marriage referendum in this country and other items like that. But you would expect it to be easier, in inverted commas, in the 2008 sections.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's just with what they've done with this play is that they're presenting these two contrasting battles. So there are still battles being fought in 2008, but they're just of a different kind. You know, where in 2008 there was a sense of sexual liberation and identity in the LGBTQ plus community, there was still a way that they had to present themselves, and the ideas of promiscuity and monogamy and how gay men and women carry themselves was still heavily monitored and almost trod down upon, in a sense. Like there was a freedom, but not in the real sense of the word. So it was just how exploring what those battles were in modern day compared to 1958.
Did you find one or other of those time frames more interesting? In some ways, I loved the unspoken nature of the 1958 section, but then the openness of the 2008 section brings its own delights.
Absolutely. Oh, that's a very difficult question. I think because there was a lot more tragedy and isolation and fear in the 1958 timeline that we could explore, and like you said, that sort of unspoken thing. But then I kind of loved exploring 2008 just to see, like, oh, but we are in a better place, but are we? And it was us asking those questions as to, well, what is it that they're struggling with in 2008, even though they have this and this?
Yeah, so it is so-called, well, a lot easier now. So what are the problems?
Yeah, absolutely.
And technically, in terms of, I mean, the challenge is that it is, yes, there's a first act and a second act. So there is an opportunity to change scenery if you wanted to in that interval. But it does flip from 1958 to 2008 to 1958 to 2008 before the interval even happens.
Yeah.
So you had to find a way, which is quite a challenge, because I love the way sometimes playwrights, when they put down scene directions, you know, oh, when we get to 2008, it looks like the 1958 apartment, but it's clear that it's 2008.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. Thanks for that lovely
no problem.
Challenge. But it is difficult to... how have you gone about trying to achieve that shift in the time frame? Because there are no big costume changes possible either.
Well, fortunately, we have a brilliant, brilliant scenic designer and head of our scenic designer in our company, Iris Lange, who's from France, who we sat down and had a lot of discussions about how we could portray those two contrasting timelines within this space and also for a very little budget. So she was looking at the aesthetic of the 1950s compared to modern day. And actually, we found that a lot of sort of the designs of the furniture and things like that are sort of kind of bleeding into sort of modern day, and you know, there's a real sense of that similarity. So we kept it very simple, very stripped back, very minimal set, I believe we have a couch, a little bar and a coffee table. And we have a little, we have a carpet. And then through costume, which is a big element of establishing time, and Fiona Ryan is our costume, head of costume on this, and also through lighting and sound, that's our indicator of going back and forth. And even different objects like props, like headphones, for example. Like, yeah, oh, it comes on with headphones at one point.
If there's any kind of music playing, you can immediately establish a different era with the music that we hear. Are there different styles of acting in terms of the writing that you're given in from 1958 to 2008? I mean, the 1958 feels like a Terence Rattigan play. The 2008 feels like a very modern piece of theatre. Despite the fact that both sections are by the same playwright.
Yeah, 100%. I think there's no particular difference in the style of acting, but certainly the way that you would carry yourself in 1958 versus 2008. And even like talking about the kind of the freedoms you have as a gay man in 2008, and the way you would hold yourself is very different from the constraints of your society in 1958. So actually we've done quite a lot on physicality and also just accent as well. So like being back in the 1958s, everyone had a much more proper English accent and all that kind of stuff, and usually had a deeper tone as well, whereas in 2008, it can be much closer to myself, which is really nice.
But on the subject of just on the little bit of the personal side of things now, we don't hear your Belgian accent at all.
No, you don't.
because you are from Belgium. So explain why a young actor from Belgium, and you studied here at the Lear in Dublin. What brought you here? What brought you to Ireland specifically?
So like a few different things. So I'm Belgian-English. So my mum's English, my dad's Belgian. But I grew up my whole life in Belgium. And I was homeschooled by my mum, which is why I still have like such a strong English accent, to be fair. A big part of it was actually just the Lear Academy itself. I came over because I'd heard about this new drama school being set up, and some really amazing actors were coming out of it. I'd seen a few when I'd been going to see plays in London, for instance.
Paul Mescal and the likes, obviously.
Paul Mescal, Colin Campbell was one who I particularly loved. I saw him in Disco Pigs in the Royal Court and just thought he was phenomenal. So that was one of the reasons I came here to audition. I met some of the tutors and I just loved it. And I decided quite quickly.
Did you have a knowledge of Irish theatre, or were you coming just because of those Irish actors you'd seen?
From the Irish actors I'd seen, and just the reputation that the Lear Academy was building up at the time, I just seemed like the perfect place for me. I remember just feeling very at home when I walked in to do my auditions and just loved it.
And in your case then, Emma, obviously moving up from Australia, it was the weather that brought you.
Absolutely. God, if I had a nickel for every time someone said that to me. My parents were both born and raised in Ireland, and they migrated when they were younger, and then I just moved back. And so Ireland has always been in my blood and my bones, and I was an Irish dancer growing up, and, you know, so it felt like a second home to me. And I was in London at the time, about, you know, maybe 10 years ago, and was auditioning for drama schools there, and I heard about the Lear from there. And I thought this would be perfect because it would be a great place to live. And I didn't really know much about Irish theatre as well. And then I saw Denise Gough in People, Places and Things, saw Dervla Crotty in Hecuba in Stratford, and thought, what is going on in Ireland? I need to get over there. And luckily I did, and was very lucky to get into the Lear and to be amongst the Irish industry.
And did you train in the Lear from the acting point of view or from the directing point of view?
From the acting point of view.
Yeah.
So I'm an actor, so my first time ever directing. Wow. Dipping my fingers in different pies, which is nice.
And that is sometimes necessary when you work in theatre if you want to make a living of any kind. The Pride is the play that we have been speaking about. It is part of the Dublin Gay Theatre Festival. It runs from May the 13th through to the 18th at the Teachers Club in Dublin. Festival runs until May the 19th, and you can find out full details about this play and indeed everything happening at the festival on gaytheatre.ie. All the Good Things You Deserve is the fourth poetry collection from Elaine Feeney, a writer probably best known for the novel she published in recent times, As You Were, from 2020, and last year's Booker long-listed How to Build a Boat. In the beginning, however, she produced three poetry collections, Where's Katie, The Radio Was Gospel, and Rise, and we're delighted she's back with new poems. And joining us now from our Galway studio, Elaine, I remember at some stage along the way, I can't remember whether you said, when you wrote the first novel, I think it was, you said to me, sure, all the money is in the novels, but you found out.
You're supposed to say that on the radio.
I think you said it to me on the radio
probably,
at the time.
It's very likely I did, and I was indiscreet as usual.
Yeah, but you found out you were wrong. In fact, all the money is in the poems, and back you went.
I can categorically say that's actually not true, but that's okay.
I guess the two things, I hardly think that you said, I'll write novels now for 2 or 3 years and I'll stop and I'll go back and I'll write poetry. I presume the two things have been running along in tandem for that period, Elaine.
Yeah, no, it's actually been quite fascinating. So I published Rise in 2017 and I just couldn't continue with poetry at the time. Yeah. I just felt the eye was so exposing and it was so personal. And I wanted to sort of tell not bigger stories, but maybe stories that had tentacles out into the world and just weren't focused on me. I was very tired of myself. So I actually didn't think I'd ever write another collection after Rise. And I did, weirdly, and I don't even know how I went about it. But anyway, I'm going to try and tease that out.
Yeah, because, I mean, you talked about it, you're talking about the I as in, you know, you yourself, yeah. that first person aspect mm-hmm. of writing poetry. And this is a familiar arc, I suppose, and, well, it's not. It doesn't always happen from trauma to love, but that is the arc that you're following here. And it is very much, it is hugely autobiographical, I'm guessing, and thinking is the case.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. And I think it took me maybe till this stage in my life to actually maybe write these poems or to maybe reveal myself in this way. And it is, that is the arc of the book, does sort of go from trauma to love or to accepting love or to even trying to write a love poem. But I don't think it's never linear in a way. Mm. And I think the collection, each of the poems in a way, there's a circularity and they keep circling back on themselves and on memory and on image and so on. But yeah, that's definitely is the arc. But the first poem that we will talk about, the titular poem from the collection, yeah. was obviously a very difficult poem to write for me. But I felt that I had a block with poetry, and when I retrospectively think about it, I think that the whole aesthetic palette of language for a poet comes from childhood and young adulthood and all of that experience. You know, we almost, language predates memory and expression in some ways, I think. And I just had to write this poem and maybe clear the decks in a way, but it made its way in.
It's a long poem, as you say, mm-hmm. consisting of, I think I'm just looking for the number here at the
beginning. 24
cantos, thank you very much. Because the final one is actually called Canto mm-hmm. Begin Again, 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 yeah. Again, Again.
But
24 is the number that you've used here. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with or telling us the story of, or part of the story of, an abusive relationship. Were you writing this from a distance? Did it take a lot of distance time-wise to be able to start to write about this?
Oh yeah, decades really. And what I was doing actually at the time was I was writing the epilogue for How to Build a Boat, interestingly. And if anyone is familiar with that, it kind of moves into a poetic scape. And this poem kept coming and coming and coming. And it was so long and so dense and, oh, I don't know how many words it ended up at, and I wanted it just to go away, but I had to. I was simultaneously weirdly writing the two at the same time, and I actually had to finish All the Good Things You Deserve before I could free myself weirdly to write the epilogue for How to Build a Boat. So, you know, I've spoken before of intrusive language and poetry. Often you wait around, you sit and wait for it, and it does come knocking, and that can be a good or a bad thing. Mm. And I think, I mean, this is a very contradictory collection. Life is full of contradictions, and it's sort of, there's a dichotomy in it, in that, like, you know, love and hate exist in the same person, and, you know, happiness and sadness, exploration and solitude. So it is that sort of, it's broken into two sections as well. And like we said,
yeah.
I suppose trauma moving to love, not to put too glib.
Yeah, it's not one big linear move from one to the other. That is not what it's about. But to give a sense of it, I mean, Canto 19, sometimes I am all panic and I run out of my house and I run. Running is a constant theme. Mm. Looking for every place you went, looking to make sure you knew the way out of the room. Or whatever space you were in, that you knew the exit route if you needed to get to it. I was also struck by the number of times across the 24 cantos that you use the phrase, "I am sorry."
Yeah, I think that'll be familiar to some listeners. And I think, I'm not sure it's particularly a female experience, but I think that I use it almost as a tick. You know, sometimes I preface the beginning of a conversation with I'm sorry, or, you know, I'm sorry for taking up space, or I'm sorry for being in this space. And so I use that strike through technique to sort of delete them, but you can still read them on the page. And it's that thing of trying to re-own my narrative for me. And that was very important with this. I was at the Courage Festival. I launched the collection and the wonderful poet Suzanne Dickey interviewed me. And it was funny, we were discussing this and I said, I think I wrote this experience in poetry so I don't have to defend myself, because I feel that, you know, many people will feel familiar with this. I've spent a lifetime of defending my own narrative, which, you know, is very much the point of the poem in many ways, is that actually I'm going to free it with poetry. And, you know, MacNeice, who's mentioned in the poem, Louis MacNeice, said something, I'm going to paraphrase, but it was, I'm not offering a final verdict. You can't expect that of poets. And I really like that poetry allows me a space, or allows me air, or allows me time, actually, for consideration.
Yeah, well, it allows the reader a lot of time for consideration as well. Mm-hmm. That opening section is one that I definitely will be going back to, because it really struck me, even on a first, second and third reading. Let us go to one of the pieces then from a little bit later into the book. Did anyone whistle? You're looking at County Galway here.
Yeah, and I'm taking it away from the eye for a minute.
Yeah.
But I was commissioned to respond to Murphy's A Whistle in the Dark for the Abbey production. I think it was 2022. I'm not great with time. The Jason Byrne production with Sean McGinley, which was just absolutely mind-blowing. I thought McGinley was fabulous as Dada. But anyway, they asked me, would I respond, and I had responded to Murphy's Mom O plays previously for the Royal Irish Academy. And yeah, Murphy sort of speaks to me in ways, I think, around less around the immigration that might be pertinent to this poem, but more just in the language and in the violence and in the familiarity of the tomb landscape, one that I'm familiar with. So
maybe you'd read the poem for us then. Thanks,
okay.
Aline.
Did anyone whistle? Run a bogscape of footed turf, ditches green and full, to a city where you sit in a cafe and drink tea till the rain eases. Bedsits and brick yards, bars for dreaming it different, as nights roll into a life and the past stretches. What sound does bog make when the young are gone? Or the reverberation of brothers fighting in a town full of threat? How does a fist sound as it curbs a tongue? Or a mother's voice in song moments before you left? Because after you left, and you all left, did anyone whistle? Now that we've been leaving for centuries, what sound has our leaving made? Here goes. There will be pain, derived from speech off kilter, language a jitter. There will be echoes. The past holds unhurried, unhinged voices, loudest from the grave. You try to be yourself with poor precision, so now you're quick to temper and speak in story without revealing. You pummel shame to silence, and this bubbling feeling in your fists, this makes them dance. Your face now in the gutter. Oh, how indestructible you once were. An iron bridge, new railway lines, the park gates where you drank. But everything faded fast, right? And who was it said, speak well of us over beyond, and whatever ye do, let ye mind yourselves.
And that's Aline Feeney reading her poem, Did Anyone Whistle, after Tom Murphy's A Whistle in the Dark, from her new collection, All the Good Things You Deserve. And I love the way you gave us beyond at the end of it there.
I didn't spell it phonetically that way, but I do say it that way, like the way I say yo.
Exactly. In fact, there's something of the rhythm of Tom Murphy's own speech within the way you've made that poem. I don't know whether you were familiar with his mode of delivery or not. What do you think in terms of, you know, the novels and the writing of the prose? Because there are some quite prosy style poems in this collection as well. Mm-hmm. How has the writing of the prose fed into the writing of the poetry, Elaine?
Well, you see, this fascinates me because I think I was always quite prosy in the poems, and I've maybe moved slightly more lyrical, actually. For maybe the earlier collections, you know, they were angsty and political, as you'll know, and you were a great champion of the early work as well, so thanks for that. But I think I moved into a space where I actually did look at the actual aesthetic and the beauty around the West of Ireland in a way that I hadn't earlier on. So I think actually... it's getting quite blurred because I'm working on a third novel and I notice that the poetry is really kind of seeping into it. And I'm just going to allow it because I thought I was making a very distinct difference with the prose and the poetry. But a lot of people say, I know you're a poet when I read your prose. So I think I'll just going to... Oh, I don't know. I think I'm just going to give in to language, maybe.
Well, because I was convinced when I was asking you about, you know, were they absolutely discreet, the writing of the novels and the writing of the... I was convinced that they would be, that they wouldn't be, that you would have been dipping in and out of it, that you might have gone and jotted a poem down, you know, as things went on. But what strikes me about this collection, and as you described it, that you certainly had to write that big title poem to get yourself started, as it were. There is that feel, perhaps, of the arc that you might get in a novel, that seems to be here in some ways as well.
Yeah, that might be just a slight bit of professionalisation, finally. But no, there is. And actually, no, that was actually my own doing. And it was funny, another poet got in touch with me after reading the first cantos and he said, you write that like a mini horror story. And actually, I thought that was quite interesting, even with all the gaps in it. He said it does read like a narrative,
very strong.
A sort of a terrifying narrative. So, yeah, so, you know, story is important in poetry as well. Sometimes it's not always necessary. I mean, I'm very experimental and very open to experiment, you know.
Well, let us finish with the end of the arc, which thankfully in this case has a happiness to it. Do you need to tell us much about Out on the Beach once more? And for Ray, you might need to explain who Ray is, possibly.
Well, Ray is my long-suffering husband. And I've finally given in to write a few love poems. And so I'll leave you with the love poem, Out on the Beach Once More. So that's a very simple introduction. Out on the beach once more for Ray. We go back Spittle way and sit on rocks, pluck seaweed ropes, listen to the sea come and go, repeat. Here you learn to father another man's son, to raise, to be, to love. We go back to the beach today, some years since convincing ourselves we mattered, you, me, we, us, repeat. I know my love poems are unwritten. I know waves leave without words. Nothing is definite. So here is my love, fleeting, and how terrifying it is to name it.
Elaine Feeney there with her poem Out on the Beach Once More, final poem in her new collection. And Elaine, it is astonishing how sometimes it is the happy ones that pack the emotional punch as much as it is the sad ones.
That is weirdly a bit, felt that,
absolutely beautifully. You read it beautifully and it really was very, very touching. Thanks for being with us this evening, Elaine. That's Elaine Feeney and her new collection All the Things You Deserve is published by Harville Secker, and that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Niall Fitzmaurice and Paula Shields researched. David Phelan was the broadcast coordinator. Liam Mullen was on sound here in Dublin, John Doyle in Galway with Elaine, and tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. I will be back with you on Monday. I'm off tomorrow night. Back with you on Monday. Another chance to hear Mary Costello and Andrew O'Hagan, Ian Lynch on his scoring of the horror film All You Need Is Death, and some of the Blána Hauige performance that we had in studio. That's on Bank Holiday Monday, and I'll be back in studio with the Villager Special live on Tuesday evening. Really looking forward to that. Enjoy your Bank Holiday weekend. Keshi will be with you tomorrow night, and John Creedon will be with you after the news.